Hi, I'm Nancy Clare, and welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest this week is Denise Hamilton, creator of the Eve Diamond series of mysteries and editor of Volume 1 and 2 of Los Angeles Noir, an anthology of short stories that take place in Southern California. Denise's most recent novel is a standalone, Damage Control, and she contributed The Thinking Machine to In the Company of Sherlock Holmes, the anthology of short stories inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon and edited by Speaking of Mysteries co-creator Leslie Klinger and Laurie R. King. When most writers join us on Speaking of Mysteries, I'm speaking to them for the first time. In the case of Denise Hamilton, we have worked together quite a bit over the years. She is an extraordinarily talented writer who is very knowledgeable about crime fiction, especially Southern California crime fiction. So our first collaboration was for the first Los Angeles Times Magazine annual mystery issue, a primer of the books that everyone who is interested in the genre should read. Denise also wrote an essay about a subject we touch on in the podcast, the dark side of the Southern California beach scene. Both articles are still available online, so I'll include links on our website, speakingofmysteries.com. Writers like Denise are rare, though, and editors scramble for ones like her who can bring prose with a lush sensibility to articles and columns. One day when we were meeting at a cafe in Glendale, California, and I was enjoying an excellent latte and a life-changing pain au chocolat, Denise started to talk about perfume. I'm not sure who had the idea that she write a perfume column for the magazine, which we called Uncommon Sense. But I do remember becoming so excited by the prospect that I started talking before I finished swallowing my most recent bite of pastry. My manners weren't pretty, but the resulting column was phenomenal. I'll also include a link to it on the site. Here's Denise Hamilton. Welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. This week's guest is a longtime friend and associate, Denise Hamilton. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your most recent book was Damage Control, and it was a standalone. Are you working on a follow-up that features publicist to the rich and famous Maggie Silver?
I am not right now, no.
And do you plan to for more novels in the Eve Diamond series?
I have about half of an Eve Diamond book written, and I need to finish it. But right now, I'm working on several other projects.
Oh, well, maybe you can share a little bit about the projects you are working on.
Yeah, well, you know, like many authors, I tend to be kind of cagey about describing work in progress. But one of the things that I am working on is a crime novel that is set kind of in an alternate Los Angeles. It's kind of, I don't know what you would call it. I guess like dark fantasy, but it's definitely anchored in the real LA, but it uses a lot of the iconography of the city and its history.
Sort of a Blade Runner-esque, maybe.
Yeah, perhaps. It also, the protagonist is 16. So I'm not writing it as a YA novel per se, but I think it probably straddles the genres. And it there's romance in it too. There's a boyfriend who disappears in a nightclub. So that's kind of what starts the book.
I think that the differentiation between YA and adult, especially in genre fiction, is getting murkier all the time. I think a lot of times it's determined by the age of the protagonist, as in your case, and the lack of four-letter words, so it can be placed in the library.
Yes, although I read a lot of young adult fiction because I have two young adult children, and you do see swearing in the YA books. You do see four-letter words. I've just read two or three that have that. They also have sex. They have they deal with all the topics in the real world. There's certainly no sugarcoating anymore. The Bobbsey twins are are long gone. In fact, the book I'm reading now has a big gay component. And, you know, it has mental illness and adultery and, I mean, just everything you can imagine and swearing, too. So I think there's a lot of crossover readers. I think a lot of adults read YA books, and I think that a lot of teenagers read adult fiction as well. My younger son, who's 16, is reading Stephen King right now, and I'm reading young adult fiction. So there you go.
Well, you know, it's I think fiction is fiction, and I think genre fiction, which is a whole other discussion of why it needs to be designated as genre fiction. I've been reading a lot of YA mysteries as well. And I agree with you. I threw in the line about the four-letter words because I attended a panel at BoucherCon that was on YA and juvenile mysteries. And one of the panelists said that she sort of skirted those words in order, because so many libraries in so many states won't shelve a book on the YA shelf if it has. They didn't mention sex, sexuality, or adultery, but they did mention swear words.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, being from L.A. And having a librarian husband in L.A., I guess that is not something that we have had firsthand experience with.
No, because the F word is we drive here, and you know the F word is well entrenched in our vocabulary. Just driving to the corner.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I've noticed is there's kind of a new category that spans YA and adult fiction, which is called new adult fiction, and that seems to be like either older teenagers or again. Novels featuring a younger protagonist, but perhaps with more details and complexity in the plot. I'm not sure exactly what the demarcation line would be, but I know that new adult fiction is something that the publishers are using to try to capture both audiences. And to me, you know, like you said, you know, It's all marketing, and to me, a great book is a great book, whether the protagonist is 15 or 16 or 57.
Yeah, Nick Harkaway, I asked him that question because his books are very sort of genre-bending.
Yes, and I love his books. He's the perfect example. Yeah, my son and I have read several of his books.
And he, you know, he just laughed, and he said, I think it's just a shelving convention for those, you know, sort of bricks and mortar bookstores that still exist. And, you know, so I use his line that it's a organizing principle, new adults, young adults, juvenile.
Yeah. You know, and I, frankly, I don't really worry about that when I write. I just, I write the story that I want to tell. And, you know, Damage Control, for example, toggled back and forth between the protagonist when she was 16 and when she was in her 30s. So half the book is about kids who are in high school, and then the other half is, you know, the ramifications of what happened during that time when they're in their 30s and trying to uncover mysteries and come to terms with all this bad stuff. These bad things that happened on the beach one night at a party.
Well, that's a good point for my next question, which was, you know, Damage Control included a subtext that you and I have talked about before, which surf noir, or the idea that the beach and its environs are not always a shiny, happy place. And it's not a new idea, I understand. Raymond Chandler had an antipathy to the Pacific Ocean sometimes. Ross McDonald's The Zebra Striped Hearse. And Kem Nunn, of course, especially in Tapping the Source, were instrumental in establishing this surf noir tradition. But can you comment on the dark side of Southern California's beaches and beach culture?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm the editor of Los Angeles Noir.
The Edgar-nominated editor, I should add.
Edgar Winning.
Oh, Edgar Winning. Oh, gosh. Oh,
that's
my
right.
Gosh.
Yeah, Susan Straight's short story, The Golden Gopher, won the Edgar for Best Short Story. And that's in the first volume of Los Angeles Noir. And then the second volume is L.A. Noir 2, The Classics. And it's funny because Akashic Books, which is this little indie publisher in Brooklyn whose motto, which I love, is, quote, reverse gentrification of the literary world. But anyway, when Akashic approached me for the second book, and they said, okay, let's do a sequel now, and, you know, we want to do the classics of L.A. Noir. And look, all you have to do is give us a list of 15 stories. And we will go and get the rights from the authors or from their estates. Because presumably if it's the classics, you're going to go back in time to the 20s and the 30s to find short stories. And they said, so really, you know, it's there's no heavy lifting here. Just, you know, give us a list of 15 whenever you're ready. But of course, I said fine because I love them and I love the project. But then my OCD-ism kicked in, and I realized I'm going to have to read every short story as far back in time as I can find into LA's history that had a crime in it, because I might miss something otherwise. And how can I pick 15 if I don't have the entire universe in my head of them? So for about a year, my bedside reading was any short story set in Los Angeles or Southern California that had a murder or a body or a crime in it. And so I read short stories by everybody from, you know, Dorothy Parker to Dashiell Hammett to Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Faulkner and you know, just tons and tons of people. Frederick Brown, people who, Cornell Woolrich, people who never made it into the collection, but I was kind of looking for to paint with as broad a palette as I could and not just have, you know, Chandler, and obviously we needed to have Raymond Chandler and James Ellroy and Walter Mosley and Ross McDonald and Dashiell Hammett if I could, but it turned out Dashiell Hammett never wrote a short story set in L.A. that I could find. For a year, my bedside reading was all these collections of short stories and magazines and things online and anthologies. And in doing so, it became very clear that, number one, that L.A. Noir really started in the 20s, late 20s, with the Depression, with Prohibition, with the rise of L.A. as an urban center, with, you know, the kind of psychological malaise of after World War I, with so many deaths and, you know, the Great War to end all wars. But secondly, in reading all these short stories, when the beach was described and the Pacific and the waves and the coast, it was not with the glamour that it is associated with today in contemporary beach culture. And, you know, it wasn't all about, you know, beautifully sculpted bodies and skimpy bikinis. And even when I looked at old photography books of, like, the Venice Pier and the beach and collections of postcards and things, you see the beach and you see people dressed in, like, black Victorian garb and leather shoes and hats and canes walking along the beach. In Raymond Chandler, people like Lee Brackett, who was this wonderful woman, pulpy fiction writer from the 40s, who wrote and screenplays and then also science fiction into the 80s and 90s. Anyway, when they described the beach, it was not this glamorous playground. It was gloomy and it was foggy, and the salt water corroded the metal and rust flakes came off in your hands as you touched things, and oil derricks were pumping, you know, sumps of oil and tar into puddles on the beach, and it was where you dumped trash, and there were these clapboard shotgun shacks on the beach with weathered floorboards. And the canals of Venice, which were in their heyday, you know, supposed to imitate the real Venice, a lot of them were stagnant, were filled in, people threw trash, there were, like, dead carcasses of animals. The poor lived there, and the, you know, the down and out and petty criminals, and it was kind of a depressing place. And that is all reflected in the fiction of its time. And it wasn't until, I think, it was Ross McDonald, we start seeing more glamorous descriptions of the beach. But like you said, in the zebra-colored Hearst, there's still kind of a grimness to it, and there's the tribes of young surfers, and there's something very kind of eerie and sinister about them gathered around the fire like primitive tribes and with their own rituals. And so it really struck me that, wow, this is not the beach that I was expecting to find. It's not the beach that I know. It's not the beach of the Beach Boys and beach volleyball, and even the beach that, you know, as a teenager that I hung out on all the time, because, you know, I grew up in the Valley, and that's what we did every summer on the weekends, is we went to the beach. And then I went to school at Loyola Marymount for college, and so we were always hanging out on the beach. But so the kind of duality of beach culture struck me. And then, of course, I've also read Kem Dunn, and Don Winslow also does a good job of writing about the beach in a kind of a spooky way. And also about, you know, the beach bums, the old surfers who never really got a job or did anything with their lives and kind of drifted into alcoholism and drug abuse and you know, the ravages of the sun on the skin. And so and from going to parties and seeing a lot of predatory behavior of the older guys toward the young impressionable, you know, high school girls. I was just kind of haunted by the idea of the beach as a metaphor for, you know, the dark side of Southern California life. That, yes, everybody comes to California, Southern California, and wants to go to the beach and dip their toes into the Pacific, but it's kind of also, as Joan Didion said, you know, the place where we run out of continent and where the dreams go to die and where, you know, if you don't make it in Hollywood and if you don't have a beautiful bronzed body and if you don't surf the waves or, you know, have that kind of lifestyle, and then you can just feel that life is passing you by or that the dream is hollow. And even if you do have a house on the beach, you can still feel that life is hollow. You have all the materialistic wealth, but maybe your husband's cheating on you, or your kid won't talk to you, or your mother died and you found out that you were illegitimate, or whatever. So it was something I really wanted to explore in fiction, and so Damage Control was the perfect place to do that for me.
Well, since we're talking about short stories, you contributed a short story to In the Company of Sherlock Holmes, which is the recent anthology of stories inspired by the Holmes-Watson canon and compiled and edited by my Speaking of Mysteries partner, Les Klinger, and mystery writer Laurie R. King. I wanted to ask two questions about this. First of all, mm-hmm. Holmes and Watson cast a long shadow on your profession and the profession of, you know, mystery and crime writing and even thriller writing. And how much did that impact you as a writer who decided, you know, a journalist who decided to be a writer and who wrote crime and detection fiction?
Well, of course, I've been a fan of Sherlock Holmes my entire life, and as a kid, you know, read all the stories and then read them to my kids in turn, and, you know, always marveled at the cleverness of Holmes and tried to pit my wits against Conan Doyle to figure things out, and, of course, failed miserably. So, yes, he certainly casts a gigantic shadow over anyone who wants to write crime fiction. I think that because, you know, I wrote so specifically about Los Angeles and kind of the grit and the glamour that's, you know, behind the beauty of the place, that authors such as Raymond Chandler probably cast a larger personal shadow for me, driving down the mean streets and, you know, interviewing the femme fatales and, you know, sitting in on the murder trials and visiting the homes of the millionaires and the billionaires, you know, in the Malibu colony and in giant sprawling Pasadena estates. But in terms of the story that I myself wrote, I was also fascinated by people who hypothesized that perhaps in today's world, Sherlock Holmes might have been diagnosed with Asperger's because he was so cold and clinical and unemotional, and he was so guided by logic, and he seemed fairly unconnected with other human beings except for, of course, his cohort. He just seemed so alone and so cerebral in his study, and Watson kind of, I think Watson had to make a lot of the overtures toward Holmes, and then Holmes would hold forth. But so I thought, what if he really did have Asperger's or aspects that today we might lump in that world of, you know,
being on the spectrum, I think they is how they
being on the spectrum. Yes, and which of course allows him to have laser focus on the intricacies of the puzzle and solve that without being distracted by other things. And so I thought, what if I created a character who definitely had Asperger's and was trying to solve something for his work, and in doing so was so focused on that he completely failed to pay attention to what was happening in his own home. So, and I had just read this story in the New York Times Magazine about analytics, consumer analytics, and how like large companies could take seemingly unconnected facts about you that were just gleaned from the public record of what you bought, how you voted, where you lived, looking at your credit card purchases, and kind of crunch the numbers in such a way that predicted future behavior. So I just, I wanted to play around with that idea that you may have all the facts at your fingertips and yet miss something that is so blatant. So maybe in a way he wasn't like Sherlock Holmes. I wanted to explore the idea of someone who could have Asperger's or be on the spectrum and be someone who was a little bit, who fancied himself like a Sherlock Holmes character who was going around solving the great mysteries of the financial consumer world and yet couldn't see the forest for the trees.
I'm curious, you know, let's forget about BBC Sherlock and Elementary, and I wonder if Holmes and Watson were consulting detectives in the 21st century, would they use algorithms in solving crimes? I mean, it just, your story, by the way, it's called The Thinking Machine, it really made me think. It made me think of, you know, you see television shows and you read some novels, especially it's kind of William Gibson-esque, where you think about are they going to start using formulas, predictive formulas, like you said, this character Bill Gleason uses, he can predict what you're going to do by what you've done, and you know, if this was taken further, would Sherlock Holmes or Sherlock Holmes kind of character or Minority Report sort of thing be able to predict or solve crimes using an algorithm?
Well, the whole precog thing is so fascinating. And I am a huge, huge fan of Philip K. Dick. I think he's just a genius. So a couple things. First of all, I think, though, that, like, analytics like that and looking at data on a computer screen, that doesn't translate very well to dramatic TV or movies. So I think that, you know, people have to be careful with that if they're making films, because it's not nearly as sexy as walking around someone and saying, you know, you've got a sunburn on the back of your neck. You must have just come back from India. Or, yeah, you know, you smell like a vetiver because, you know, you must have been in this place doing that or whatever. But I do think that if Sherlock Holmes and Watson were solving crimes, absolutely they would use this as a tool, but I think it would just be one of the many tools in their arsenal. I don't think they would shy away from it, because I think Sherlock Holmes, being that unemotional, very clinical person, would use every single thing he could, and he would never shy away from technology. But I don't think he would use technology to the exclusion of all his other senses that have always served him so well. But yeah, he'd probably be writing his own algorithms to figure things out.
In addition to writing mysteries and editing anthologies of mystery stories, you are a committed perfumista. In fact, you solved the perfume mystery for Speaking of Mysteries. I'm just curious, we've talked about this before, but not on the podcast. What do you find compelling about scent and pursuing scent?
Well, first of all, I just have to thank you for allowing me to write a perfume column for the LA Times Magazine for several years.
In our sort of glorious past.
Yes, and, you know, that was so wonderful. And, you know, I hope that you read all the wonderful comments that people wrote about the column, because it just really seemed to hit a nerve, and people loved the idea of a perfume column that wasn't, like, filled with PR gobbledygook about, oh, the PR hype about, oh, the new release from Balenciaga. Let's try that again. The new release from Balenciaga, just, you know, kind of overhyped based on, you know, which model was the face of it, and in all the exaggerations that the supplier made about it. That what you allowed me to do there was kind of treat it as an art form and, you know, have inquiries into the creators and the history of it as an art form and what intriguing people were doing today to further the art form and how it's connected with all our five senses and connected with art and music and food and that there really is a community out there of people who are fascinated by it. But the way I got into perfume, well, it dates back to my childhood. My mother was a white Russian and French, and she grew up in Nice in southern France, and then immigrated to the United States. And she always had a shelf of perfume bottles, of perfumes, all French perfumes. And when I was a kid and those long summers in the valley and I was bored, I would take them all down from the shelf and play with them very carefully and, you know, but look at the bottles and the stoppers and try them on and sniff my arm and, you know, pour way too much into the bath and just soak myself in scent and think about it and just, you know, the sensual pleasure of it. And I've always had a very strong sense of smell and, you know, for both good and bad. Like, I cannot stand scented cleaning products. They just smell so artificial to me. They just make me want to barf. But so I always had perfumes myself. I would buy them for myself, or, you know, people would buy them for me. And I never had just a signature scent. But my mother liked all the classics, you know, the Guerlains and Carols and Yves Saint Laurent and Chanel's. So I was familiar with all those, and I followed it. But about, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, I was in the thrift store. I'm a huge thrifter. I love antiques, and I love finding, you know, some 1940s designer dress on the rack next to all the, you know, the cheap thrift store stuff. I love finding that needle in the haystack. But anyway, so I was looking at they had a perfume by Donna Karan called Chaos. And it was in this beautiful bottle, this glass bottle that looked like an icicle sliver. So they took it out for me and I sprayed it on and I thought, whoa, this smells like church incense. This is too much. Having grown up Catholic with those censers swinging in your face, I was just like, oh my goodness, no, 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 that's not me. So I wandered around the store and I kept thinking, oh, what's that smell? Oh, yeah, that's that perfume. Gee, that's really interesting. Boy, that's really overpowering. And then I got home, and I couldn't stop sniffing my wrist. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. I'm compelled to keep sniffing myself. What is in this perfume? So I Googled it and looked it up, and it turned out that the perfume was discontinued, and people were selling it for $300 a bottle on eBay. And the bottle was, I think, $29.95 at the thrift store, which was pretty expensive for the thrift store. But at that point, I immediately called the Goodwill, and I said, do you still have that bottle? Oh, can you hold it for me? I'll be right back. Because I thought, oh, Christmas is coming. I'll sell this. I'll buy it for $30. I'll sell it for $300. And, you know, I'll make myself a tidy little bundle to buy something for the kids. So I brought it home, and I don't sell on eBay. And so I thought, I'm just going to, you know, I got caught up with the kids. And so it sat on my dresser for a couple of days. And each morning I would think, what is it about this perfume that makes people want to spend $300 on it? Instead of just move on to it, I just find a different perfume. And so each morning I would spray on a little, and then I would sniff it. And something about, like, around the fourth day, I sprayed it on, and all of a sudden I'm just intoxicated and in love. And so I looked at the notes, and it had lavender and incense and cardamom and agarwood and spices, and I don't even remember what else, but all of a sudden, I loved it, and I totally got it. And I thought, yes, I would spend this money on the perfume. So long story short, I never sold that perfume. But it started me on this kind of online journey of researching notes of perfumes. And so, okay, what other perfumes smell like chaos? Or what other perfumes has Donna Karan made? And then thought, oh, she's made one called Black Cashmere. Well, I need to try that. And that led me to this whole online world of perfume, and where you can buy little, there are different sites on the internet where you can buy like little tiny glass vials of perfume, so you can sample them first and see if you like them. And then I realized that I found out that there were many, many perfumes out there that were not in the department stores and that you could not find at the mall. And so I found out that it was very much like artisanal bread making or cheese making or wine, that there were all these kind of independent perfumers who were making these wonderful small batch perfumes. And then, of course, Guerlain and Caron and Chanel and all those brands that were 100 years old had continued to make wonderful perfumes. So it just, my universe just kind of blew up, and I just tumbled down this rabbit hole of obsession into perfumery. And, you know, over the years, became quite an expert on it and have a gigantic collection. And you know, because I think as writers, we often feel that we have to write about something in order for it to exist, or we write about it to figure out how we feel about it or to document it. I was so thrilled to be able to write about this lore that I knew that I had in the column, and kind of explore different aspects of it and do interviews with French perfumers or look at just a certain note like orange blossom and, you know, how that's used in perfumery and all the different facets of it. And people seem to respond to the column. So it was, I'm just sorry that the magazine closed and I lost my bully pulpit. But I must again thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Oh, well, that wasn't the motivation for the question. I mean, I'm although thank you. And Maggie Smith in Damage Control was also perfumista, and she was a publicist. And I think probably my last question is, you know, I think that it's interesting that the two protagonists, or the protagonist of your series, Eve Diamond, is a journalist, which you were a professional journalist, you still are a journalist. And Maggie Silver is a publicist, and these are two professions that are forever trying to outmaneuver each other. And I was wondering, which was easier to write, and which was more fun to write?
Well, they're all fun to write because I have to spend at least a year with them, and so if it wasn't fun, I don't think I could do it. I don't think, for instance, I could write about a financial analyst. That just wouldn't be fun for me. But, you know, I think that because... And obviously, being a journalist is something that I knew a huge amount about, personally. And I knew a lot about the PR world and the damage control world because I would have to go head-to-head with those folks when I was trying to wrestle facts out of them for a story. But I think in this case, I really wanted to approach it from the opposite side of the spectrum. I also wanted to load my protagonist down with lots of challenges and flaws and difficulties and problems.
Next week's guest is David Joy, whose much-anticipated debut novel, Where All Light Tends to Go, is scheduled for publication March 3rd. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.